Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002, goes out every Friday afternoon at 2pm on BCFM 93.2. This week, we talked to Sabine McNeill from victimsunite.net. She's been to see one of the top MPs. Also, we talked to Grayson, who does bike tours around the city of Bristol. But we start this week with victimsunite.net's editor, Sabine McNeill. Hi, Sabine.
Hi, Tony.
This week you've been to see John Hemming MP. Now, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he is completely unique because he stands up and out for not only secret prisoners from the Court of Protection, but also all of those children who are snatched or stolen or neglected. And I organized a meeting for him before, but today it was special because we just presented questions to him. I collected them online and by people who couldn't attend, but then also people who were there. He involved them beautifully in the discussion. So we had an hour and three quarters with him, then had a quarter of an hour still in the room because all of the voices just sing of the same hymn sheet of despair, frustration, anger, and God knows what else comes up in terms of emotions.
Well, I mean, John Hemming, what party is he and whereabouts is he a MP for?
Well, he is Lib Dem, and it's a place called Yardley in Birmingham.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because quite often, if you write to an MP, you may get they may come back to you with the excuse, oh, well, you're not in my constituency, you're not a resident of mine, therefore I don't have to answer your letter. But the fact of the matter is, some MPs are quite happy to look into matters which aren't actually in their own constituency. So John is obviously spreading the net much, much wider.
Yes, it's very, very true what you're saying. I've had enough emails of that same kind of ilk as well, but it's clearly up to the MP themselves. And he also covers the full spectrum of white-collar crimes, but he happens to concentrate on the child-snatching aspect because he chairs a campaign called Justice for Families, where he has collected at least 1,700 cases, if not more by now.
Good God. That's an incredible amount. Now, I know you mentioned right at the start this Court of Protection. I mean, I've seen several horrendous stories, some in the Daily Mail and other national newspapers. Occasionally it gets a mention on the television too. Even if it's not on the British television, I think it was Al Jazeera I saw of all TV stations doing a piece about the Court of Protection. Now, this is the court where you can actually be, for trying to look after your family and relatives and friends, you can actually be put in jail.
Well, that's what the secret prisoner is about. And if you like, Vicky Hague, who is one of the most prominent victims of child snatching, she said, well, I'm a secret prisoner because I was convicted in a secret family court. So that and how these two are connected is, in my observation now, the secret family courts are set up to steal children and the Court of Protection is set up to steal the assets, especially of elderly people. And the first time I learned about it was from an expatriate whose aunt was declared not to have mental capacity, and that's how then the official solicitor gets hold of the assets of such people who don't supposedly have mental capacity. And John Hemming said very clearly that it's very difficult to kind of restore that judgment once somebody has been declared not to have mental capacity. It's a complete joke, and I mean, it is just so inhumane and horrible that I'm only too glad that at least we had the opportunity to discuss it, especially because one victim turned starfighter, as I call them, a guy called Len Lawrence. He was a pilot, and he suffered from the exhaust of the fumes and has been poisoned, and in the process was declared not to have mental capacity. And then assets were kind of going missing in the process. And by now, he certainly has mental capacity, and I don't know whether he ever did not really feel he didn't have it. But it's just one of these completely repressive mechanisms that one shouldn't think were possible in the 21st century.
No, certainly not in a civilised society. In your estimation, what's behind this? I mean, who's actually got this whole thing moving? It does seem to me it must be some person or group of people who have absolutely no interest in, you know, justice being seen to be done. The idea that these things are all happening behind closed doors, that journalists aren't allowed into these courts, even members of the family of people affected are not allowed into the courts.
Well, it's either sex or money or both, and then depending on whom you talk to in terms of how much experience they all have had, it boils down to Freemasons covering each other and protecting each other at all costs seems to be the motto. Whether there is a genuine policy of kind of exploiting the general public and being as mean as horrible and kind of letting them suffer as badly as possible, that I wouldn't like to say at this point.
I mean, do you actually have any evidence of the involvement of Freemasonry? Because this is often, you know, when you see something happening you don't like, people often just accuse, oh, this is the Freemasons. But do you actually have any evidence?
I don't have exact evidence, except that my co-organizer, Belinda McKenzie, read out yesterday some passages from a book about Freemasonry, where somebody was interviewed who had left the Freemasonry for Christian reasons, and 2 years after the book came out, the author mysteriously died or was killed. So there seems to be a bit of a problem if people expose Freemasonry, but I certainly know that in Wales the net is very, very tight, and I have colleagues in Wales who have evidence, big evidence, but I personally don't. I just remember one article in The Guardian about Freemasonry in the police.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is even just last year. Nick Davis was writing in The Guardian explaining that much of the activity going on with the phone hacking and the secret activities of the police to do with all that were actually being conducted through Masonic lodges in the civil service and in the police. So, I mean, there certainly is some of that sort of activity. But, I mean, ultimately, the big problem, of course, is the oaths of secrecy that the Masons swear when they join makes the organisation rather too cult-like. But anyway, moving on a bit, with your discussion with John Hemming, is there any way forward, do you think, through campaigning to stop these and basically close these unjust courts down?
Well, actually, I think he's not in a strong enough position yet, and if ever he will be is another question. But for me, what became quite clear that there are three ways forward. One is private prosecutions as the Achilles heel, so that one can kind of go after people as a litigant in person. On a more public level, or the public interest advocacy, that you are also behind a judicial review as the tool. And we have actually lodged yesterday our first judicial review against the UK Border Agency, because they are responsible for at least 6,500 foreign national children being taken into care, and I don't know how many foreign nationals in prison in general, but at least some 80 or so in Holloway. And our next JR judicial review will be against Holloway, that I know. And the third line of change has to be protest. In fact, I learned that from a barrister who was talking about the loss of civil rights, that her solution was only protest. So this third line of activity will be taken on board on July 19th. When the parents who lost their children will be outside Downing Street to request their stolen children back.
Oh, interesting. I think maybe a bit of a breakthrough to have barristers and other lawyers involved too, you know, people within the legal campaign, profession campaigning too. Anyway, Sabine McNeil from victims-unite.net. site which you edit has got, I mean, you have probably every couple of days another new explosion on your blog. Amazing that you managed to keep it up there on cyberspace, and well done. So thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
Thank you.
Bye.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Well, I'm joined by Grayson Hill. Grayson, you do bicycle tours in Bristol.
There were several reasons which made me start doing the tours. Firstly, to be honest, I used to work in call centres on the sales and, not surprisingly, wasn't very happy with it. So I ended up chucking that job in, delivered a few pizzas on scooters. Then for a short while I worked for Sustrans doing the fundraising, Sustrans being the cycle charity. And from that I came up with the idea of cycle tours around the harbour, as at that time there was nobody else doing it.
Okay, well, isn't it a bit dangerous because you've got the railway tracks, can't the bicycle... I mean, we had someone killed, didn't we, recently? Potentially, anyway, we think it may have been because they got their bike wheels stuck in those railway lines.
Yeah, indeed, and it was an issue I needed to take on board. But to be truthful, the person who had that accident went right in front of the M shed when there's clearly a sign pointing go to the right, which is safer for cyclists. The guys I cycle with, we go at a very slow pace. I give a massive health and safety about the tram lines, and so far not one single person's had a problem.
Okay, so take us on a little bit of a tour of the harbour then. What sort of things can you see? I mean, quite often, you know, Bristolians, we have a wander around, don't we? But we probably wouldn't go right the way round. Do you go right the way round with your tours then?
I certainly go right the way round. I always start at Perrow's Bridge by the Youth Hostel Association.
But that's round about where the Arnolfini is that
yeah,
right?
Exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah, okay. Arnolfini. And we go through Queen's Square. And from there we go over to the St. Mary Redcliffe Church, and then we zoom back down to the harbour via the Quakers burial ground. Around the harbour, well, there was just so much history there. Of course, we stop at the Redcliffe Caves, carry on past the back of the M shed, down towards the SS Great Britain, and continuing on to the viewing point at the suspension bridge. We then
hang
come
on a
around,
bit of a, you know, a bit of a hill there, isn't there?
Oh no, there's no hills.
Up to the suspension
not up
bridge.
Up to the viewing point of the suspension bridge.
Oh, okay.
If you actually go past the Create Centre, there's a nice little path directing you to the viewpoint now. Yeah, the actual going up to the suspension bridge, that's only for the likes of the RAF when they're on their big group tours. But okay. I'm looking forward to that.
So, yeah, it's interesting that the forces want to take your tours. Okay, so when you're coming around the other side, mm-hmm. you come over through, I suppose, what is the dock, the lock, isn't it?
Lock,
tell us a bit about the history of the harbour in Bristol then, because I imagine, I mean, if you look at the city... from a very historical perspective, right, literally wind back a few hundred years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it clearly was an incredible natural port with the Avon Gorge, very easily defendable. I mean, a lot of people in years gone by must have looked at Bristol and thought, there's a good place to have a city because no one's going to be able to invade us by sea because they got that horrible Avon Gorge to sail along, and we get plenty of warning. The other thing is they might get a few of their boats in, but then when the tide goes out they'll be stuck. So it's a great defendable port historically. So when did they first start thinking about creating the floating harbour, you know, the idea of actually keeping the water in rather than letting it run out twice a day?
Absolutely. That was from 1804 to 1807. They went ahead with that engineering.
Don't tell me it only took 3 years.
It did, only took 3 years, and all dug by man alone. No machinery used, apparently.
Good God, that's incredible. So that's when they put the actual the lock gates in, mm-hmm. right, where you're talking about, where you can see the suspension bridge from.
Mm-hmm. Well, in actual fact, that's Brunel's locks, that part there. He actually modernised them so larger ships could get into the harbour. The original entrance was at the the pump house, you know, the pump house, that's where the original entrance was.
And what about the cut? Because that goes round, doesn't it? And that's that is definitely tidal. When was that built?
Well, that was all part of it. From 1804 to 1807, they built the new cut going around, and then they built the lock gates.
That just amazes me that something so massive nowadays, looking at it, can be constructed just within a few years like that. Amazing. Shows how very different things are today. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, by hand as well. Unbelievable, Grayson. Okay, so when you're coming round the other side, things have changed a lot, haven't they, around that particularly? You've got lots and lots of luxury houses all around that area now, rather than the old docks. And someone somewhere has realised that actually having a view out over the docks is worth much more than having an empty warehouse doing nothing.
Indeed. And I always bring the modern history into it as well. I always inform people about how the docks were closed in 1975, and because, you know, the ships were getting too big to come so far inland. And I explained that there's lots of questions of what to do with the air, and people were apparently talking about building roads over it. And it's then that I show them that, of course, the property being very lucrative, it's done Bristol very well. And of course, that the tourism is getting better and better.
Well, I notice it seems almost every summer there's more and more people actually out on the floating harbour doing sort of leisure activities, sailing, all this kind of thing as well.
Absolutely, it's getting well used. I mean, I think it was a bit of a shock to the Bristol people at first, but they've done something with the harbour which is really worthwhile. And it's not only tourists there. There's many a Bristolian down there, you know, having a drink or doing fishing or sailing or whatever. So I think it's good for everybody all round.
And what about other little bits of history? I mean, for example, I know that there's I think it's the River Frome, isn't it, that comes into, which is a sort of weird thing because it disappears some way out of the city centre and then it kind of pops up. So what happens with the Frome? It runs under, I think, quite a large part of the city centre that's been built on.
Absolutely. There's actually, they're called culverts, which are little pipes which run into the floating dock. There's actually four of them. The two major ones, so there's one clear entrance you can see which actually goes into Castle Park and joins the floating harbour, and then of course there's the one right in the centre where the hippodrome is and the fountains. The fountains are under those is actually the Frome, and that's why they got that water feature there. Of course, that used to be open, but in the late 1800s they had to fill it all in or cover it up because of a cholera outbreak, you see. But
that's interesting. Didn't realise that. Quite nasty. I hope there's not a load of cholera under there still.
Well, I've not heard anything, but I don't think they will ever reopen it for those sort of reasons.
Okay, well, that's pretty much covered most of your tour around the harbour. What about that? You do another couple of tours as well, one down the Avon River. Now, you know what? I love the sound of this because you're obviously not going to be going up any horrid steep hills like up to the Clifton Suspension Bridge, anything like that at all, up and down the river. So what sort of things are there to see up and down the Avon River, and how far is the trail?
Sure. Well, it's a good extension, I have to say, for the actual harbour tour, because then people will understand about the locks and the new cut. What sort of trail is it? Well, we start off again in the centre on the harbour, go up Feeder Canal, which obviously links to the waterways again, and then if you carry it on, we can then go off road and follow the River Avon, and it's nice there, but then it just gets much nicer because then it goes into the Conham Riverside Park. It's quite interesting actually, because there was always a lot of industry there, a lot of mining. Of course, you've got Troopers Hill, and there used to be a lot of pollution going on. In the 1930s, when they actually closed all the mines, and so that land was then given to the National Trust to look after. So what you're actually going to when you go through there is beautiful National Trust land, which is totally natural.
So how much is there still of the evidence of the old mining works?
I wouldn't say there's a great deal, as you'll just ride in the bike down along the river, but it is worth actually just locking the bike up for a few moments and going for a walk up some of the trails, because then you can come across small brick buildings and you can see that there is obviously something going on.
It sounds like almost like a kind of archaeological bike trail as well.
It is fascinating stuff, it really is.
And so how far actually up the Avon do you go before you stop and come back again?
Yeah, let me have a think. Well, from town, I suppose it's about 4 miles. It's very, very close. And the first time I discovered the area, I just couldn't believe there was such beautiful land so close to the city in Bristol.
And a lot of history too. And your final tour is the Bristol Street Art Tour. Now, obviously, a bit of Banksy. So, what are you doing? You've located where some of the most famous Banksys are. This must be great for the tourists.
Indeed. I mean, this is a new tour, which at the moment I am very much promoting. I know where the major Banksys are, which are, you know, still intact and everything. But also there is a lot more out there. I go up to Bedminster, up to North Street, where they recently had the Upfest 2013 art fest. And there's some incredible, really is some incredible pictures up there. And already the people I've shown have been very impressed. And then up to Stokes Croft, which, well, I've described on my website, there must be more street art per square meter there than anywhere else in the world.
Well, possibly. Well, I mean, it's one of the interesting things. I mean, I travelled quite a bit to the Third World years ago, and I was amazed by the amount of graffiti and art that there was. And I think, you know, I don't know whether you agree with me, but it seems that when a lot of the mainstream press, media, is not expressing stuff, that people think, well, never mind them, let's just go and spray it on the wall, whether it's words, whether it's pictures, whether it's art. We don't see a lot of sort of popular art in our colour magazines of our newspapers. It's mostly fashion stuff, you know, mm-hmm. sort of grotty kind of annoying things. And it's not finding its way into the national consciousness that way. But it seems like it, certainly in Bristol, it finds its way directly into people's faces.
Absolutely. And it's a great way for people to express these feelings.
Just give us an idea of a couple of the more quirky bits of street art that you take people around to have a look at that maybe people might not have noticed.
The more quirky ones, if you go down Moon Street, there's absolutely loads of them
down
there.
This is at the bottom, I think it's the bottom of Stokes Croft, isn't it?
Yeah, right at the bottom of Stokes Croft. If you go down there, you can see quite a few very small little quirky ones, and there's lots of different styles. There's stencils, there's stick-on things. I mean, when I took somebody down there last time, they were more interested in that than some of these big murals which you see. And so,
but what about other people? I mean, Banksy's obviously the super famous one. What about are there some other artists that we should know about you think are up and coming that you've found little bits of street art from?
Well, I do feel that he's another big one. Inky's another big name. And I do think you have to appreciate his work. Then there's the other ones I'm thinking of are more at Bedminster. They'll be truthful. It's two people, and I can't quite think of the name now.
But what sort of style is it?
Be truthful, it's a bit dark. It's a little bit dark, but it's got that bit more depth to it, you know.
Okay. So this is your latest tour. How long do these three tours, the harbour tour, the river tour and the street art tour, how long do they actually take?
Sure. I try to say between an hour and a half and 2 hours, but I'll be truthful, if people are really enthusiastic and we're rebounding ideas off each other, I let it go on longer, just because It's so enjoyable.
Yeah, it sounds great. Anyway, more power to your elbow, Grayson. And the other thing I suppose I should ask is, have you managed to get little leaflets into the hotels around the city? Because that must be a really good... I mean, people are only here for a couple of days, and if you're able to help them hire bikes to come on the tour, that's a great way to spend for someone that's just in the city for a little while to spend their time and get fit too.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. To be truthful, I haven't, because if you go to a hotel, you then have to wait to see the manager. And then if you finally do get to see the manager, you still can't be sure that they will be put there, that they will be looked after. So I've tended to go more for the online option, especially as 99% of my customers come from online things, but the Visit Bristol site, which is basically the tourist information of Bristol online. That's by far the biggest way. Though I still have leaflets and I do still put them out, but in restaurants and bars and other places, but I still have very little response.
Listen, Grayson Hill, it's been a real pleasure to have you in, and more power to your elbow. I hope you manage to do more and more of these tours into the years to come. Finally, how do people, if the listeners, get a hold of you?
Well, best way perhaps is to look at my website, gocycletour.com. As it says on there, you can send me an email or just send me a text or give me a bell on the phone. All the information is there.
And what about for people who aren't actually on the internet, as quite a lot of maybe older listeners might not be, so what's your phone number? How do people contact you on the phone and text you?
07982 429 716.
And you better just read that again.
Oh. And I will indeed repeat that. 07982 429 716.
Okay, Grayson, it's been a real pleasure having you. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you very much, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And it's time to speak with the smiter of the high and mighty, that is to say the Bristolian and one of its secret writers. I reckon you must be, Jason. You've not just got Private Eye with you this week, you've got Bristol's own version, which is the Bristolian, with you, haven't you? So where do you want to start this week?
Well, we're going to start with something covered by the Bristolian in the June edition of the Bristolian. This is about Kia Group, a group of civil engineers poised to take over May Gurney, that is the company that runs Bristol's waste collection.
Oh, that's right, because I remember reading, I think in a previous Private Eye, that May Gurney, who have got the council's contract to collect all the rent, are going bust. They've got some sort of massive debt, they can't repay it, rather like First Bus. It seems almost all these companies, including First Group, you know, who run the trains and the buses, they seem to have some massive debt burden that they've got from somewhere, and so they're having to spend all their time and effort paying back banks rather than actually doing the job they're paid for.
We could do a section on transport problems in Bristol.
That would be here all night.
Yeah. Yes, but yeah. In this particular case, the problem with the Kia Group is that they're notorious blacklisters.
Now, okay, just remind us what a blacklist is. It doesn't sound good.
Blacklister. In this case, what they do is they talk to people like the Consulting Association, who are an industry bankrolled spy outfit, and they have a secret do not employ database.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because there may be literally thousands of people out there looking for a job who are on this database, who unbeknownst to them, every time they apply for a job, their name goes bleep on some database, and then their job application gets thrown in the bin. Now, is that legal?
Not really. Kia's got a long-held reputation of doing this to employees who call for safer working conditions. So it's...
That's interesting.
Yes.
Kia are doing quite well at the moment, though, aren't they? I mean, they've just got a contract, for example, to build the new £250 million hospital in Broadmoor. So it doesn't seem that the government's funding contracts depend on whether you're doing blacklisting or not.
It's not the only contract they've got. Anyone who knows me well knows that I travel quite often. They also I'm originally from Maidenhead. Of course, we're part of the Crossrail project.
Okay.
One of the that's going across London. One of the terminals at Maidenhead, and that's going to link on to the next bit I'm going to bring up here. It's about the private eye, and this one's talking about. This one's from the private eye, and this one's talking about. This one's talking about rail, and it's talking about train operating companies, saying that introducing competition between train companies has played a crucial role in reversing the fortune of the railways. That means that it's attracting more passengers. But if you take a look at ticket costs, especially recently, they've been going up quite a lot. A standard class anytime return ticket, it's £308 from London to Manchester, £212 from Bristol to Leeds.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, you can fly backwards and forwards all day, couldn't you, for that? Probably a week.
Yeah. It's travel and season ticket prices rose 2.4%. Season tickets are 1.1%, and advanced tickets rose 5% comparing to the last quarter of 2011-12 and 2012-13. Passengers on all types of tickets, passenger miles on all types of tickets have fallen. So actually now no longer passengers rising. So the
statement, well, I mean, isn't that because people are managing to get wise to this and buying tickets in advance and getting them cheaper, do you think?
Quite possibly. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I've travelled here today on a ticket that cost me £47.50.
Gracious alive. Well, I mean, can you not book these a little bit ahead and get them cheaper, though, Jason?
Yeah, if I know what I'm doing the rest of the week, because, as you know, if there's a few weeks I haven't been turning up because I've been at job interviews in London. So I don't have, as long as I'm not doing a job interview in London. So, yes. Yeah, good. I've got my ticket here.
Signal failures. That's for the little section that's in Private Eye every fortnight. Mm. And I think, if I remember rightly, is this one by Dr. B. Ching?
It is by B. Yeah, Dr. B. Ching.
That's right. Like he's some sort of Chinaman.
Dr. B. Ching. Wow. It's amazing. I have a friend who works at the Didcot Rail Centre, and man, you should sort of stuff he has to come out with about Dr. Beeching.
Yeah, you don't mention Dr. Beeching to me, because then I will remind you about this book, which came out a few months ago by Richard Cotterill, C-O-T-T-R-E-L-L. He used to be a Tory MEP for the southwest of England, but he was also the editor of the magazine for BAC, the British Aircraft Corporation, when they used to be, well, before they got sort of turned to mush. Probably in the 1990s, and because they virtually don't do anything anymore. I mean, it's kind of been taken over by BAE Systems, who do some of their civil stuff. But anyway, BAC used to actually make aeroplanes, and that was Richard Cotterill's job. But he published this book called Atomic Bomber Beeching and His War on the Railways as a Kindle edition. I'm not sure if it's actually out as a paperback yet. He's got such expertise on all of the backstory to how the railways in this country were closed down. And Richard himself believes that in the future we'll see these old lines resurrected, because we simply won't be able to afford to carry on in the future, I mean, environmentally and socially, in having, you know, most people been getting around by car, because it's just not practical.
It's interesting. I mentioned Crossrail, which is partly run by Kia, and this is going from Maidenhead or Heathrow, Maidenhead and Heathrow Airport, to areas like Shenfield and Essex. I'll also point out, coming back to the whole Kia thing and the May Gurney, that the City Hall's former waste services contracts manager, the one who oversaw this floor next winter contract, is one Giovanni Lopresti. That is the younger brother of Jack Lopresti, the Tory MP who went to Saudi Arabia.
Really? Giovanni Lopresti?
Yes.
And what was his job in the city council?
He was the waste services contracts manager.
How interesting. Gosh. Find out some amazing stuff from these, Jason. You wouldn't believe this stuff. So this is a younger... Jack Lopresti, the Freemason... is this the second time we've had the Freemasons on this show? The Freemason MP...
I'm going to come to the Rosicrucians in a bit, so you're going to love this.
Filton and Bradley Stoke, who... he was an honest Freemason, and when he was forced to by law, he declared when he was a city councillor that he was a Freemason, which I picked him up on. The only trouble was he promised to take me on a tour of Freemasons Hall at the bottom of Park Street, that anonymous building, and he promised to give me a copy of the Masonic book, which has got all the names of who the Freemasons are in Bristol, and on both counts he didn't. So unfortunately, he wasn't really delivering on his promises. He passed the buck to someone else and said, oh, someone else will do it. And then when I phoned to someone else, who was somebody, Rawlings, who's the sort of secretary down at the Masonic Lodge down in Park Street.
We're not hit, bye.
He just basically said no. See, they don't do that. They don't say no. They say, I can neither tell you yes or no. Which is a bit frustrating. Okay. Rather like, funnily enough, Prince Charles's guy who was on Dispatches earlier this week. I don't know if you saw that on Monday. Dispatches. It was a really interesting Dispatches this week, which was a bit like Private Eye. And it was looking into Prince Charles and all these secret property deals that he does, because he does everything he possibly can to keep it from the public. I mean, for example, all the money that Waitrose make through their distribution depot, he's collecting his little pound of flesh. from Waitrose, or because he owns the actual distribution depot where all the Waitrose lorries are going from. Now, you know, if I was Waitrose, what I would do...
It's time to get lost.
Yeah, I'd drive all my little lorries somewhere else. So he'd be sitting on a distribution depot and not getting any rent for it, but it would obviously be worth some money. It seems there's a bit of a close relationship between Waitrose and the Duchy. Well, not only that, but also they're building some kind of Waitrose, it seems, in Cornwall on Duchy land. So there seems to be quite a close relationship between them.
I see.
So here's a question which I saw someone was asking on Facebook the other day, Jason. Marks and Spencer's or Waitrose? Which is the poshest? And is one of them shabby chic or what?
Well, as somebody who lives in the rural borough of Windsor Maidenhead, my family shop at Waitrose and my sister works for Waitrose.
So long as you're giving Prince Charles his pound of flesh every time he goes shopping.
Well, he's currently employing my sister, so I can't really say anything.
But the guy who... Oh, is he? Okay.
Waitrose are.
Not quite directly employing, but sort of vicariously, sneakily. But anyway, it was Prince Charles's representative from the Duchy actually being grilled a few years ago as part of this documentary by the Public Accounts Committee. And they were saying to him, are you going to deliver these documents? And the guy said, well, I can't really say yes or can't really say no. You still haven't persuaded me that it's a good idea. And this is the way that they react to interrogations by MPs about whether they should tell them what they're doing or not. The thing with the Duchy, and Duchy of Cornwall, is that it's as halfway between a private and a public body, you know, because obviously Prince Charles is a public thing, you know, he's not just a private person, he gets plenty of money from the state as well as many other things, and he also has state duties, so he's a sort of public person. But then in all of his financial transactions, he doesn't pay any tax, saying, well, I'm a special case and I'm not a corporation. So he treads this rather dangerous line in between private and public. We've just talked a little bit about the Masons and their dissembling ways. Yes. Mr. Rawlings down at the Masonic Lodge in Park Street, who hides in there in his... You have to tap on a certain way on the door in order to be allowed in to see him. And also Jack Lopresti and his younger brother organising the contract with May Gurney, this company that's gone bust, basically. And they're having to be rescued by somebody else. Mm. But what about the Rosicrucians, the War of the Roses? What's this all about?
Rosicrucians. The reason I said War of the Roses is because we talked about what it is a bunch of horrible people Rosicrucians were not too long ago, and I was surprised to find that a very popular Japanese card game you may have come across, Yu-Gi-Oh. It's a Japanese card game, sort of aimed
card
at,
game.
At kids and teenagers. They did. They did a War of the Roses version of one of their games, where you either sponsor the Red Rose team or the White Rose team, and the two main characters, Yu-Gi-Oh.
Because the War of the Roses was between Yorkshire and Lancashire. The Yorkshire being the Red Rose and Lancashire.
No, other way around. Lancashire were Red Rose.
Lancashire were the Red Rose. Yorkshire, oh gosh, sorry for any of you Northerners out there getting that around the wrong
but
way.
But it's interesting because this was picked up by a Japanese cartoon game. But the really weird thing was, they had the two main characters of Yu-Gi-Oh representing... the main character Yu-Gi was representing Henry Tudor. And instead of having Kyber, his arch-rival, representing Richard of York, They had him representing Christian Rosenkreuz, who was the founder of the Rosicrucian movement. And I just thought it kind of shows the sort of impact that the sort of level at which these people operate. If the Japanese children's card game is bringing up something like...
It is interesting, isn't it?
I suppose the apocryphal figure such as Rosenkreuz, you know.
Well, I think Dan Brown would probably have something to say about it. But I mean, these secret societies are actually quite interesting in that you can find out some interesting actual concrete facts about them. A lot of it's disinformation. Any idea how you sort out the real facts from the disinformation?
Well, it's interesting because the whole thing about Rosenkreuz is that there's actually no historical record of him.
It's interesting because, I mean, some of this stuff, I mean, it's a bit like modern witchcraft. A lot of it has been just sort of remanufactured, repackaged, like some sort of PR company has taken the whole idea of witchcraft. I think it's just Lawrence Gardner did this. Not quite sure what period he was around, but the idea was to introduce this new version of it, to sanitise it and change it. And actually, it's got nothing to do with real history. A bit like the ley lines, you know, this whole business of ley lines. There's very little evidence that people actually took any notice of this back in prehistoric times. And yet, this is a whole nother, almost a discipline which is brought out. Chemtrails is another one, you know. There's a whole load of people talking about...
Well, yeah, I mean, I've seen some of these programs, Ancient Aliens, and they've got that horrible sort of Greek-American guy who's there, and he's like, no, aliens.
But do they really exist? Well, I'll tell you what, one of the best, I think on all of these types of subjects, one of the best books you'll ever find is David Southwell's book, which we on this programme about 4 or 5 years ago serialised, called Secrets and Lies. And it really does go through all these various different conspiracies and gives you plenty of information on each one to make your own mind up. I mean, basically, he decides, you say, look, this is a load of nonsense. This is real. This is a load of nonsense and this is real. And if you want to check it out, he gives you all the facts that you need to go and, you know, look it up online or get the right books.
I'm surprised I haven't borrowed this book in the UK or the US, you know.
He is, yeah, a really nice guy, David, as well. He's a bit of a sort of artist. You can follow him on Twitter. I think it's Cult Author, he calls himself. But he lives on a barge near Paddington somewhere in London. and just churns out. The last time I spoke to him, he was talking about doing a fascinating-sounding book called Off the Map. So these are sort of weird military places that you won't find on the Ordnance Survey map. And having
Area
a whole
51.
Book, that sort of thing. Well, but I mean, he's talking about particularly for the UK, you know,
UK.
Sort of things that you might, if you're in a particular part of the country, you might want to go and have a peep at and take a photo of.
And get arrested for.
I don't know about that, but you know, places that aren't supposed to exist.
It's amazing how much of that Simpsons episode where Lisa Simpson finds Area 51A and they go, Area 51, there's Area 51A, and the soldier points at a map and it says, you are here, we are not.
All right, well, Jason, lovely to see you again. See you next week, we hope.
Well, possibly, yes, hopefully.
Okay, thanks very much.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And now I'm joined by Paul Fernie. Hi, Paul. We're getting towards the outskirts of the universe. We've hit Neptune. What is Neptune? How far is it? Give us its vital statistics.
Right, yes. We're sort of at the... we're getting towards the outskirts of the solar system now. Neptune is now the 8th planet from the sun, and... because of Pluto's demotion from planetary status, it is the furthest planet from the sun now. Diameter of Neptune is 30,776 miles. That's versus the Earth's 7,926.
Sorry, is that bigger, smaller?
It's bigger. It's quite a fair size bigger, yes. It's sort of at least sort of 4 times bigger.
Now, do we know much about planets like this? Because they don't. Some of them don't seem to have a defined surface. So it's a bit difficult to say where the atmosphere ends and the surface actually starts.
Yeah, it's... I mean, Neptune was visited by Voyager 2 on the 24th of August 1989. And it took a lot of images and we discovered a lot about Neptune. Neptune has... the highest recorded wind speeds of any planet at 1200 miles an hour. It also has Jupiter's got the great red spot. Neptune has a dark spot, but unlike Jupiter's giant red spot, which has sort of been a permanent feature for a long time now, Neptune's dark spots come and go. There is believed to be a surface beneath the atmosphere.
Yeah, but no one's quite managed to go there yet.
No, he's quite managed to go
but
there.
What about the spot? Before we leave the spot, is it a storm? Do we know what it is?
Well, scientists believe it's an area of high pressure within the general atmosphere that comes and goes. I mean, you know, the wind speeds there are pretty high. I mean, I wouldn't like to try and put a fence up.
Gosh, a sort of thousands of mile an hour hurricane.
Yeah, 1,200 mile an hour wind is pretty rapid.
What about moons?
Neptune's got 13 known moons. Most are pretty insignificant by moon standards. The largest of which is Triton.
Triton?
Triton, yeah.
Okay.
Triton.
Not Titan,
Triton. And Triton's quite unusual, actually, because unlike most of the other large moons in the solar system, which, if you looked at the planets, travel from left to right in front of the planet, so they travel in the direction that the main planet is rotating, Triton actually travels in the opposite direction. So it travels from right to left if you were looking at it.
Okay, so this might hit one of the other moons, no?
No, actually...
I keep asking you this from the other ones.
You keep asking me this, and yeah. I finally got one you might be interested
in,
Tony,
okay.
Because Triton is slowly being pulled in towards Neptune, and possibly...
So don't tell me, in 5 million years' time, it might...
Don't
crash.
Hold your breath, but there is the possibility that it will be ripped apart by Neptune's gravity and form a new set of rings around Neptune. Neptune does have rings.
Oh, that's interesting, because that's a great theory as to why... these rings form is that not necessarily any other reason that you've got a moon going round that slowly gets
too close.
Yeah, and it gets pulled apart by gravity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Triton is also geologically active. So it shows that stuff is going on at this sort of distance. I mean, distance from the sun is nearly 3 billion miles. I mean, it took 12 years for Voyager to get there from Earth. So, you know, we're talking huge distances here. But it does show that stuff is going on out there. You know, there are nitrogen volcanoes or frozen nitrogen. When Triton's in its winter phase, nitrogen freezes on the surface. And then as it warms again in its summer phase... this nitrogen then erupts as sort of nitrogen geysers, if you like.
Okay, so summers and winters, how long are their years compared to our years?
Well, Neptune takes 16 hours to rotate about its axis, so
that's
slightly
a day.
Shorter than a day, which is shorter than the Earth's. However, it takes, since its discovery, it's only been around the Sun once. It takes 164.7 years to orbit the Sun. I mean, it's travelling a distance... in the region of about 30 billion miles to go around the sun. You know, it's a long way out there. Interestingly, Neptune, from 1979 to 1999, Neptune was actually further... This was when Pluto was still classified as a planet, was actually further away than Pluto because Pluto's orbit crossed Neptune's and thus it became the closest one.
Okay, so Pluto came inside.
Is
there any other connection with Pluto?
Yeah, it is now. It's now thought that Pluto was possibly once a moon of Neptune, and it escaped the velocity. It escaped the gravity of Neptune. However, the sun's gravity stopped Pluto going any further. We'll look at Pluto and its partner dwarf planets next week, and that sort of will take us to the very edge of the solar system, Tony.
And then. The universe is our oyster.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll have a look at Pluto, even though we're reminding ourselves it's not a planet next week.
It's not a planet, no.
Okay, Paul, thanks very much.
Thanks, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And it includes Jeff Sparks. Jeff, what's on?
Hello, this is a What's On guy from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 5th of July, Sylvain of New York Dolls fame and Gary Powell of the Libertines fame will be performing with support from Charred Hearts and Hollywood Trash at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Elmore James. He was born in 1918 in Mississippi, United States, and died in 1963 in Chicago, United States, aged 45 years old. He was a blues guitarist, singer, songwriter, band leader, and he was also known as the King of the Slide Guitar. His career spanned from early 1950s until his death in 1963, and he released many singles and only one official album. This song was recorded in 1961 in New Orleans, and is the classic Shake Your Money Maker. ¶¶
Shake your money maker. Shake your money maker. Shake your money maker. Shake your money maker. And then shake your money maker. 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 And then but I don't believe she will. You gotta shake your money maker. Shake your money maker, baby. You gotta shake your money maker. Shake your money maker. You gotta shake your money maker. And then I tell her to. She won't shake her money maker. Won't shake her money maker. She won't roll her acky daggy. She won't shake her money maker. She won't shake her money maker. She won't.
Elmore James with Shake Your Money Maker. Into Saturday 6th of July, Stan Webb's Chicken Shack will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Finally, on Monday 8th of July, the Temperance Movement will be performing at Moles Club in 14 George Street, Bath. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 7pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. And you can do that or download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks very much to our studio guest, particularly Grayson Hill, and his number again is 07982 429 716 for those bike tours. That's 07982 429 716. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and everyone and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. So that was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Yes, I did.